In the summer of 2013, a man named Mr. Wright had sent me an erratic letter depicting his fears of a local anomaly that he called the Lampman of Bedfordshire. At first, I struggled to decipher his messy script, but I was taken back by his claims. According to Mr. Wright, his quiet town of Little Barford, Bedfordshire, had been tormented by the Lampman since the 40s, and the residents had simply accepted it. Mr. Wright didn't seem to know what the cause was, but stated the town had strict rules and curfews to keep its 2,000 occupants safe. Mr. Wright had shown his concern ever since a young girl had recently gone missing. When I first told Mr. Wright that my urban myth Tumblr was user-submitted stories and that I never actually visited the town, he refused to believe it. In fact, he became far more assertive, and rather than suggest it, "I see Little Barford," he demanded it. It wasn't until a further 15 messages that I figured out that Mr. Wright wasn't a gentleman who lived in a quiet town with his loving wife and kids. Instead, he was a 15-year-old named Ronald Wright. After I pointed out his poor grammar and asked for ID, he soon came clean. Although Ronald had been lying about himself, he had been very truthful about Joyce Byrne, who had disappeared just a few days before his first email. After finding out the truth, I firmly rejected his proposition, knowing he was a kid knocked out all formality I had, and I ignored his further emails. I can't say the story didn't intrigue me. In fact, I debated posting it to my Tumblr, but on the weird off chance that it was real, I decided not to. I even researched into the small town of Little Barford. I only found articles on the construction of their power station 50 or so years ago. December soon came along, and I had finally forgotten about Ronald. His emails had been directed straight to my junk box automatically. However, just days after Christmas, I had set foot inside the junk box searching for a butcher code my uncle had gotten me and came across a recent email from Ronald with the subject, "I broke the rules. The Lampmen are coming for me." I opened it. The title was intriguing, and the fact he was still emailing me caught my interest. In the email, Ronald addressed his previous email and how I had been ignoring him, and he even went as far as to predict I hadn't been reading them. Ronald spoke about how nobody else had gone missing since Joyce. Ronald had gone out at night in hopes of finding Joyce. Ronald laid out a few of the rules the town had been following, and they read, 1. Do not go near the lights off the road path at night. That is a lamp man. 2. If you see a lamppost that does not belong, do not approach it. 3. When navigating roads at night, use a lantern. If you see a tall source of light approaching you, you must drop the lantern and hide. It might be too late. 4. The night curtains must be drawn tight. If you have electronics on, make sure the light doesn't lead outside. They will find you. Little Barford was mainly a long road lit by the orange glow of candlelit street lamps, each scattered carelessly at odd distances. Fields fade into dark abyss, but the light pollution of nearby towns brightened the sky. Despite this, the sky was painted with an abundance of bright pinholes. The taxi stopped at a row of bungalows, each one covered with an aged thatched roof. It was as if the town was frozen in time. Ronald pulled me inside frantically, and his eyes were wild with tears. "Did you break the rules?" he screeched with urgency. His pubescent voice sent shockwaves through my body. "No, no, don't worry," I reassured. Ronald relaxes slightly, but the atmosphere remained thick and suffocating. Before I had gotten to take my coat off, he had shoved an unkempt and small green book into my hands. The dyed letter flaked off at the spine, and some of the page threatened to spill out. Ronald stared at me with impatient hues and wordlessly nodded at me, as if permitting me to open it. Inside was the name Sheila Wright, in a neat, cursive ink. "Your mother's?" I asked. Ronald shook his head and slightly flipped to a page with a folded corner. In the top right was the date, 2nd August, 1940, and underneath it read, "Mother and I closed the curtains this morning and read by electric lights. We no longer need the fire from the lampman to read during the dark." Father wasn't as excited, and he left for his new job at the power station in a huff. This evening we did not offer our fuel to the lampman, and Mother turned on the heater as a special treat. I wonder if the lampman will go hungry. I bit my lip in anxiety, my teeth scraped at the dead skin. Ronald watched on with huge eyes, as if I hadn't gotten to the most critical part. I flipped to the next page. 3rd August, 1940. Father did not return last night. I wonder if he lost his way. Mother said that he would be back soon. As it got dark, I saw the faint glow of one of the lampmen. He was not far away. Instead, his flames had grown dull. I snuck some fuel out to him, and he seemed grateful. 4th August, 1940. The lampman from last night came back with others. Mr. Evans, the next door neighbor, threw water over them and screamed at them to leave. It seemed like nobody cares now that we don't eat them. Sheila's diary contained a lot of information, a mass of details you'd expect to be in a teenage girl's diary, and only brief information about the lampman. Up until 10th August, Sheila's dad had been missing for over a week at that point. There had been no sign of him, and a few other locals had disappeared, including Mr. Evans, who had gone for a nighttime walk. Sheila had continued to feed the lampman the owl each night, and in return, they had guided her home for a few times after spending evenings at her friend's house, and even returned a brooch she had lost. She had noticed that the nights she had failed to supply them with kerosene, people had disappeared into the night. Many people began to fear the lampman, and soon enough, a list of rules was spread around the small village. These were the same rules Ronald had informed me earlier, plus an extra one. I had almost missed it. My eyes threatened to skip past the familiar words, but when I spotted number 5, my body and heart froze. 5. Do not miss a feeding night. I flipped the page to find that it had been ripped out. "Ronald," I said through dry lips. "What happens when you miss a night?" I asked. The young lad stared at me, lips spread wide and straight in a look of pure guilt. His ghostly features washed into the pale wallpaper behind him. "I don't know. People disappear, and most of the time it's the people just driving through." There was a still part of me that refused to accept the situation. Every fine detail about this town and its apparent lampman technically made no sense, and read like a local folk tale. "Where's your grandmother?" It felt like the only sentence that left my mouth ended with a question. "She died near Easter," he admitted, "just before I emailed you." Ronald played with his fingers, a nervous disposition. "We found her body in the woods and near where she used to drop off the kerosene. She had a bad liver, she said, from drinking some nasty stuff when younger." I removed my coat and headed into the living room. Ronald's house had a strange homeliness to it. Vintage pictures lined the wobbly walls, as well as furniture and decorations that didn't belong to this century. The smell of damp and petrol was covered poorly by the candles. "Did you keep feeding the lamp, man?" I asked. The sentence felt foreign, and I struggled to push it past my lips. "Until recently," he nodded. "I can't buy kerosene. I just use what Grandma had stored." That night, I slept in the spare bedroom. As much as Ronald tried to hide it, I knew that the bed once belonged to Sheila. Ronald's mother had worked the night shift and, lucky for me, didn't dare step into her late mother's room, even if its snoring leaked through the cracks of the door. At first, it was difficult to fall asleep. Everywhere in the house stunk of fuel. The spare bedroom was the worst for this. In the middle of the night, I turned on my phone's flashlight to discover a party of fuel containers under the bed, all empty. I had found this when I dropped my glasses accidentally. When I pulled them back up, they were coated in a strange substance, something too red to be kerosene, but too watery to be paint. Whatever it was the source of the stench. I spent the next day studying the diary, as if I had a test coming up. I'd have liked to get information from the locals, but there was an odd sensation of a strangeness and anxiety that came with the thought. Despite that, it seemed like all the information needed was laid out before me. All thanks to Sheila. Night 2 is where it got interesting. Despite my unwillingness to speak to the locals, I was brave enough to venture outside. It's strange how social anxiety works like that. Ronald had begged me not to go, but armed with a little bottle of kerosene that I had bought earlier, I had felt like I had solved the issue. I left Ron's house at 9 p.m. The road was much darker than my arrival, and I could see the sky much clearer now. I didn't dare think about the details behind it out of the fear itself. The stink of kerosene followed me into the woods as I used my phone screen to make it dim light. It was almost too dark to see, but I knew I'd tempt danger by using the torch function. It felt like I was traveling through the woods for miles. But I was confident I had reached Sheila's steps despite the low visibility. The trees came to a stop, and I found myself in an open space where the grass had turned to stone. Ahead and in the darkness sat the stone monuments, most resting at a height above my knee. The air was heavy with a smell of similar to gasoline, just like the smell at Ronald's house, and the further into the woods I traveled, the more pungent the smell. Sheila had offered no more instructions beyond this, so I placed the bottle on one of the stone structures and returned the way I had come. Beyond the trees, just meters away, an orange glow leaked between the trunks, and I called out, "Ron, over here!" My feet began to move on their own, and I traveled in a brisk walk. Bizarrely enough, the smell became more aggressive. The closer I got to Ron, the more my brain hurt at the intensity. Only it wasn't Ron. The closer I got, the better look I got. The light source sat around 12 feet, a height that little Ron would never reach without ridiculous methods. I didn't stop walking. The mystery of light in the middle of woods fueled my curiosity, and the excitement of lamp men being real caused waves of electricity to soar through my body. With steady steps, I made sure not to trip over overgrown roots. My body swung 180 degrees at the sudden crack of a branch just meters away. And behind me, at the stone structure, stood 3 street lamps. The figures surrounded the fuel I had left, and I watched as one of them took the container with lanky and ornamented arms. It opened what I could only describe as a window to its face and peered a bit into it. The flame inside weakened into a slight orange glow, and it shrieked the stone so high it felt like daggers had stabbed my ears. The two otters began stepping back in shock as the otter threw the container into the floodgate. It didn't take a genius to figure out something was wrong. I ran fast than I had ever before, back through the woods, back through the small town, and back to Ron's house. I stood in shock with his mother as I burst through the door. You can imagine the shock on Ron's mother's face as I burst through the door. However, she was surprisingly accepting when we explained the odd situation. Ron's mother, who introduced herself as Marie, was more than happy to discuss the topic, and even provided insight into details we hadn't known prior. After a cup of tea, I explained what had just happened and how the lampmen had rejected the kerosene I supplied them. There was some left upstairs, asked Mary, shock painted across her delicate features. No, I bought some, I informed, and Mary let out a sigh. She bit down on her bottom lip as she decided whether to share something with us. It's not just the kerosene, she uttered. Her lips froze in place, and it made her speech difficult to understand. I waited in silence for her to continue. My mother makes it with blood. Excuse me? I stuttered, a laugh bubbled up at my throat as the bizarreness tickled my sides. Murray's face remained straight, a perfect poker face if it wasn't for the hint of concern in her eyes. I straightened my back up and cleared my throat. Go on. She mixed it. 1 liter of blood to 5 of kerosene. I watched on as Marie crossed her arms. She couldn't take it in her old age. I tried to help her, but for some reason, they rejected mine. She stopped. The air was strangely heavy, yet empty. I couldn't help but guess that maybe that's how Sheila passed. Unlike Mary, I did not have a great poker face. And as soon as my eyes landed on Ron, she tensed up. She explained that he wouldn't do it, out of fear of needles. And the little venom in her words hinted that she could not hide her frustration. The rest of the evening was equally stressful. There was a constant back and forth between both mother and son as Mary pushed and pressured Ron into facing one of his fears in return for saving his own town. Both parties looked towards me with pleading eyes, as if they were begging me to side with them. If Ron didn't try this, then what would happen? People had gone missing. Sheila had informed us of that, but did we have evidence? I couldn't side with either. How could I? I was stuck in a modern-day ethics dilemma. Who would stay behind if there were 10 spaces on the lifeboat but 11 people on the ship? Who perishes so the others can live? Is there a way to fit everyone on the lifeboat? Ron stormed up the stairs in a huff, and a tearful-eyed Mary stared at me. I avoided eye contact. Suddenly, the pattern on the carpet was the most exciting thing in the world. Am I a bad mother? She sputtered. Am I a bad mother if I go against his wishes? He's still a child, so... Mary paused and nervously swallowed a globe of spit. If I slip him some zoopy clone and just take a bit of his blood, does that make me a bad mother? I suddenly became aware of just how harshly my nails were digging into my palms. The stress of being the deciding factor was making my stomach do. I'm his mommy, and I know what's right, she justified. Did she not know I was basically a child too? How could she ask a 19-year-old what's right? I don't know, I whispered. Technically, it didn't matter to me what happened to this town. I could just leave. Mary and Ron could just leave. I could get a taxi to the train station and maybe, just maybe, forget about this after a few months. Mary broke down into complete sobs. Her shoulders bounced with each shaky breath. I still refused to look at her. I need to do this. I need to. She inhaled deeply. He wouldn't know if he's sleeping. Ron knew. He was gone in the morning. He left no notes or messages. But his neatly made bed and missing essentials were more than enough to tell Mary and me that he did not plan on coming back. The coward in me was unable to leave a grieving woman alone in a town full of beasts, but my sleepless nights and anxiety and fear of being taken had begun to take a toll by day 3. By day 4, I received an email from Ron. He told me he was okay, and he didn't intend on coming back. He told me to keep away from the town, that I don't want to be there 5 days after the landmen haven't been fed. I don't think he realized that. Despite being gone for 4 days, it had been 5 days since they hadn't been fed. A shriek rang through the house, and I sprinted to see a manic Mary passed up against the door. The dizzying scent of gas ran havoc throughout the house. They're outside. They're all outside. She shook. Everywhere. I sped to the living room and pulled the curtains open a millimeter. At first, the daylight blinded me, but I could see dozens of street lamps scattered across what was meant to be an empty country road. My heart dropped to my stomach and joined the tsunami of anxiety within it. Outside every house and on each side of the road stood a motionless lampman. Shakily, I closed the curtains, but my hands remained with a tight grip on the textured fabric. Shit, shit, shit. Mary cowered. The back door, we need to leave, I called out. Mary's back garden led out to a large field, the perfect escape from the lampman. Mary made it out of the back door first, but we stopped suddenly. In the distance, scattered across the area, there were more of them. Numb moving, but mancing. I gagged on the smell and pulled Ron's mom back into the house. What we do? We can't leave. Mary dropped to a kitchen chair and rested her face in her palms. Rather than offer her an I don't know, I let the silence settle. Light radiated in from under the curtains and dimly lit each room. It seemed like a nice summer day outside. However, the sky remained a dull gray. The warm orange light that crept in belonged to the lamp men, and it served as a constant reminder to Mary and me that we were in danger. We should try at night. Something clicked inside Mary, and she gained a sudden authority. We'll go into the field where there's less of them. If it's low light, we might be able to sneak through. Every hour or so, the lamp man grew closer in the field. Luckily, by the time it was dark, they were still hundreds of meters away from the garden. Mary and I stood in the darkness of her garden as she mapped out our escape route. Once over her gate, the field's grass brushed against my tights and Mary's hips. Okay, crouch and follow me. We shuffled through the jungle of grass. The blaze tickled my chin, and my claves burned from the strain. Mary led us towards the woods. She claimed that if they were out on the streets, the woods would be the easiest method of escape. Providing we get past the singular lampman that guarded it. Once we arrived at a dangerous distance from the beast, it became clear that was where Mary's plan ended. We watched the lampman, hopeful that it would just leave. But then was wishful thinking. Inside the woods, the branch cracked and it turned to the sound. I wondered if they were able to see or if perhaps they used some other senses. I signaled for Mary to stay still and crawled a safe distance from her. Using my phone's flashlight, I shined a light towards the figure, and it paid no notice. It wasn't the evidence I needed, but it was enough for me to make a rough and desperate guess. We needed a loud, constant noise, not the thump of a thrown stone or a crack of a branch. Something to scream, "I'm here," without putting either of us in danger. I unlocked the screen. The brightness hurt my eyes. I then turned on a podcast loud enough to be heard by the creature, and it definitely caught its attention. I hardly had time to react as the lanky monster came sprinting towards the noise, desperate for a kill. Within seconds, it closed the gap between us, and in a panic, I threw the phone. The screen's brightness had me blind in the dark, and just as my eyes adjusted, I was able to make out Mary's silhouette. And very quickly, her face was lit up by a warm orange. I watched as she dived for the phone as it stumbled back to draw it, but it was far too late. Mary's body was lifted into the air, her screams attracting the attention of the surrounding lampman, who paid no notice for me as the fierce one pulled the woman in half. The spread of viscera lit up from their lights, the crimson liquid and guts glistened into the now open faces of the surrounding lampmen, and instead of dim orange light, their flames grew solid and bright. She had light about her blood. Shakily and quietly, I rushed into the woods. With each step, the liquid in my stomach scaled my throat like a mountain, burning my throat. I don't know how long it took me to find civilization, but I didn't care to tell anybody what happened when I did. Police assumed I was some sort of runaway, but once I was ready to talk, they helped me get to home. 7 years later, I find a strange comfort in living in a city these days. I know that as long as the streetlights are modern, I am safe in their artificial white glow. If you ever find yourself driving through a little Barford, put your foot down and don't stop until you're far away. The town belongs to the lamp men now.